and pager explosions this week killed at least 37 people and injured thousands. We'll go to Beirut. Then 40 days out from the U.S. presidential election, the uncommitted national movement says we can't endorse Harris, but we oppose Trump and voting third party is a mistake, they say. We'll speak with the co-founder of the uncommitted national movement. And as President Trump continues to refuse to admit he lost the last election, we'll speak with filmmaker Michael Primo. He embedded with three Trump supporters around the 2020 election in his new documentary, Homegrown. One of the men he followed was sentenced to one of the longest prison terms for participating in the insurrection.
There's a sheriff. Yeah, you got pulled over. Not with Trump flags, but.
Not with Trump flags, we're not.
Nah.
If, as long as I wasn't.
You could shoot somebody and you would get pulled over.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli military jets bombarded southern Lebanon Thursday, while Hezbollah struck sites in northern Israel after mass walkie-talkie and pager explosions Tuesday and Wednesday killed at least 37 people in Lebanon and injured thousands more in what's widely believed to be a coordinated attack by Israel. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah accused Israel of crossing all red lines as he addressed the week's attacks in televised remarks Thursday.
War crimes or a declaration of war, you can call it anything, and it deserves those words. Undoubtedly, we have been subjected to a major attack in terms of security and humanitarian aspects, unprecedented in the history of resistance in Lebanon. We say to the enemy's government, army, and society that the Lebanese front will not stop before the aggression on Gaza stops.
Despite the widely condemned attacks on Lebanon, Israel's doubling down on its intent to expand its war in Lebanon. This is the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant.
Over the past several days, we have held a series of important discussions. This is a new phase of the war. It includes opportunities, but also significant risks. Hezbollah feels it is being persecuted, and the sequence of military and defense actions will continue.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has postponed a trip to Israel early next week amidst the mounting tensions. Associated Press reports Gallant warned Austin ahead of the attacks this week that Israel was launching a military operation in Lebanon, but did not give any more details. Deadly Israeli raids are continuing in the occupied West Bank, including in Jenin and Kabatia, where a video has been circulating showing Israeli soldiers pushing dead bodies off a roof after a raid that killed at least five Palestinians. The desecration of corpses is considered a war crime, but Palestinians say the Israeli military frequently violates the deceased bodies of its victims. During the Kabatia raid, Israeli forces also opened fire on a group of journalists filming the events. This is an eyewitness.
Israeli special forces, fully equipped, raided and surrounded the area. They started shooting grenades and missiles. They struck young men at our place on the rooftop as they were trying to escape the trap.
Israeli attacks on Gaza have also continued, with deaths reported over the past day in Gaza City, Jabalia, Nusayrat, and Beit Hanun. The official death toll in Gaza since October 7th has topped 41,000, with nearly 100,000 wounded, though the true toll is certainly much higher. A UN committee on Thursday accused Israel of engaging in unprecedented violations of the Convention on the Rights of the Child over the past 11 months.
More children have died in this war than men or women. That is massive. And I think when we think about it, and we know that under international humanitarian law that Israel admits it is bound by, killing of civilian targets on this scale is unacceptable in international humanitarian law and international human rights law as well. And children are always civilians.
Here in the U.S., three Democratic lawmakers Thursday introduced a bill that would restore emergency funding to the U.N. Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, after the U.S. suspended its contributions and in January and later passed a bill barring any further funding of UNRWA until March of next year. Resistance to Israel's U.S.-backed war on Gaza continues on college campuses as the new school year gets underway with more protests and calls to divest from Israel. On Wednesday, Cornell University students shut down a career fair featuring weapons manufacturers supplying Israel's war on Gaza. Meanwhile, a chapter of the activist group Students for Justice in Palestine is suing the University of Maryland and College Park after the school canceled an October 7th Gaza vigil. In campaign news, Donald Trump said Thursday Jewish voters would be to blame if he loses November's election. Trump made the remarks at an event by the Israel American Council titled Fighting Antisemitism in America.
The Jewish people would have a lot to do with a loss if I'm at 40%. If I'm at 40%, think of it, that means 60% of voting for Kamala, who in particular is a bad Democrat. The Democrats are bad to Israel, very bad. I mean, Chuck Schumer is a Palestinian.
North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, a Trump-supported, trans-bashing Republican gubernatorial candidate, referred to himself as a black Nazi and expressed support for reinstating slavery. That's according to CNN, which reports Robinson made the remarks over a decade ago on Nude Africa, a pornographic website. CNN also found Robinson called Martin Luther King Jr., quote, worse than a maggot, repeatedly used anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim slurs, and said he enjoyed watching transgender pornography. Robinson has a long history of backing anti-transgender legislation. On Thursday, Robinson denied CNN's report.
Let me reassure you, the things that you will see in that story, those are not the words of Mark Robinson.
While many have called for Robinson to drop out of the race, he has vowed to remain. A former longtime CIA officer has been sentenced to 30 years in federal prison for sexual assault. Over 14 years in the CIA, Brian Jeffrey Raymond drugged, photographed, and assaulted women he met while stationed in various countries. Disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein pleaded not guilty to a new sex crime charge in New York this week. Weinstein, who's been accused of rape and sexual assault by over 80 survivors, is currently awaiting retrial after a 2020 rape conviction was overturned. He was separately convicted in 2022 in a Los Angeles rape case and remains behind bars. Earlier this week, a federal judge in California dismissed a sex trafficking and sexual assault lawsuit against Weinstein and Madison Square Garden chief executive James Dolan. In the United Kingdom, five women have accused the billionaire former owner of the Harrods department store of rape. Others accused Mohammed Al-Fayed of sexual assault and harassment while they worked at his luxury department store in London. The revelations came as part of the new BBC documentary Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Mohammed Al-Fayed died last year at the age of 94. Meanwhile, France has been gripped by the horrific case of a serial rape survivor, Gisèle Pelicot, as it plays out in open court. 71-year-old Gisèle Pelicot's husband, Dominique Pelicot, confessed on the stand this week that he recruited dozens of men for over a decade to rape his wife after drugging her so she was unconscious. The case has roiled France as throngs of people have come out to show their support for Gisèle Pelicot during the trial.
I would like to tell Gisèle that we hear her words. I am here to speak for the victims, to tell them that we are listening to them, we will fight for them, that the impunity of men is over.
Gisèle Pelicot chose to reveal her name and have a public trial in order to give a voice to other survivors. In climate news, the World Meteorological Organization warns the globe is on track to exceed 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, likely bringing about widespread climate catastrophe.
2023 was the warmest year on record by a huge margin. Leading international data sets say that the first 8 months of 2024 are also the warmest on record. There is an 80% chance that the global mean near surface temperature will temporarily exceed 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels at least one of the next five calendar years.
In more climate news, severe flooding from heavy rains in West and Central Africa has affected 4 million people, with nearly 1 million people left homeless. More than 30 people are dead in northeastern Nigeria after a dam ruptured and caused floodwaters to sweep across the city of Maiduguri. Aid groups say 150,000 children are in displacement camps, with many disconnected from their families and no access to drinking water. A record number of wildfires have been recorded across South America this year, surpassing the prior record set in 2017. Smoke recently blanketed up to 60% of the skies above Brazil, choking major cities like Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. In Budapest, Hungary, the Danube has overflowed its banks after heavy rains pushed the river to its highest level in more than a decade. On Thursday, the European Union committed billions of euros to aid recovery efforts after the worst floods to hit Central Europe in at least two decades killed at least two dozen people and destroyed homes and infrastructure from Romania to Poland. Meanwhile, Portugal's government has declared a state of calamity as more than 100 wildfires continue to rage. At least seven people have died in the fires. Back in the United States, in Tennessee, a federal trial is underway for three former Memphis police officers charged over the killing of Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black father who was beaten to death following a traffic stop in January of 2023. On Thursday, prosecutors showed the jury disturbing body cam video showing officers Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith milling around and failing to render medical aid to Tyree Nichols, who was slumped on the ground after he was brutally punched, kicked, tased and pepper sprayed by the officers. Nichols died 3 days later. The officers are charged with violating Nichols' civil rights, failure to intervene, and obstruction of justice for conspiring to cover up the killing. They also face murder charges in a Tennessee state court. Two other officers, Emmett Martin and Desmond Mills Jr., pleaded guilty to federal civil rights charges ahead of the trial. The Justice Department has launched a civil rights probe into the Mississippi Sheriff's Department that was home to the self-described goon squad. The six white deputies were convicted for raiding a home and torturing two black men. You can see our coverage of this case at democracynow.org. In Kentucky, Letcher County Sheriff Sean Steins was arrested Thursday and charged with first-degree murder for fatally shooting District Judge Kevin Mullins after an argument in the judge's chambers. Authorities say they're still investigating a motive in the sheriff killing the judge. And housing justice advocates celebrated the introduction this week of the Homes Act by Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Tina Smith. The social housing proposal would establish a federally backed development authority charged with financing union-built, energy-efficient homes across the U.S., where rent would be capped at 25% of household income. The units would remain permanently affordable by keeping them out of the hands of corporate landlords, prioritizing cooperative and land trust models instead. The homes would benefit those most affected by the housing crisis, including unhoused people, people of color, low-income families, single mothers, and immigrants. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Lebanon, where reports suggest Israel appears to be linking its southern Lebanon border to Gaza. As we broadcast, the Associated Press is reporting Hezbollah has launched 140 rockets into northern Israel in what is said is retaliation for Israeli attacks in southern Lebanon. This comes as Al Jazeera reports Israel's reserve forces commander said earlier today, quote, "It is time for Lebanon to suffer as well, the power plants, bridges, airports and seaports as well," unquote. Al Jazeera has also reported on videos from Israeli government media sources that show Israel's minefields on Lebanon's border are being cleared to, quote, make way for what most likely will be a movement of ground forces into southern Lebanon. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Thursday Israel will keep up military action against Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Our goal is to ensure the safe return of Israel's northern communities to their homes. As time goes by, Hezbollah will pay an increasing price.
This all comes after Hezbollah leader Syed Hassan Nasrallah denounced the deadly Israeli attacks that blew up walkie-talkies and pagers across Lebanon Tuesday and Wednesday, killing at least 37 people, including children, and wounding thousands more. As Nasrallah delivered a televised address Thursday, sonic booms from Israeli warplanes shook Beirut.
We say to the enemy's government, army, and society that the Lebanese front will not stop before the aggression on Gaza stops. We have been saying this for 11 months now. It might sound repetitive now, but these words come after these two big blows, after all these martyrs, all these wounds, all this pain. I say clearly, whatever the sacrifices, whatever the consequences, whatever the possibilities, whatever the horizon to which the region heads, the resistance in Lebanon will not stop supporting the people of Gaza and the West Bank who are oppressed in that holy land.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says the explosions in booby-trap pagers and radios in Lebanon seriously disrupted Lebanon's health sector. The WHO's representative in Lebanon said 100 hospitals were involved in responding to the crisis.
You know, what happened for the last 2 days actually was an unprecedented incident, the explosion of different gadgets. And it's been used, not the normal explosion materials, it's been used a different. So it's sometimes, it's very difficult actually to know exactly the short-term and the long-term impact of this substance that's been used for the explosion. But I think the expert, and as well as in collaboration also with WHO, now we are trying to study more exactly what happened, how it happened, what kind of material is being used, and how it's affecting the people that have already been wounded, which is over 3,000 people, and also 37 people have died so far.
For more, we go to Beirut, Lebanon, where we're joined by Rania Abouzeid, Lebanese-Australian journalist and author who is based there. Welcome to Democracy Now! First off, as you join us from Beirut, where there has been this wave of attacks, people are concerned about a second wave of explosions involving electronic devices. At this point, the figures are something like 3,500 people injured, 37, including children, are dead. Talk about the response on the ground, Rania.
Well, there is certainly a sense of heightened anxiety as people wonder what else, what other devices in their vicinity may explode. They wonder if anything that they're holding in their hands or that might be in their homes could be weaponized, turned into an improvised explosive device to maim and kill either them or the people around them. There is also anger about the attacks. The fact that people, you know, they didn't target combatants in a battlefield, but rather people going about their everyday lives. These devices exploded in supermarkets. They exploded as people were driving their cars. They exploded in people's homes. The hospitals, as you mentioned in that report, were overwhelmed. More than 100 hospitals rallied to try and help the thousands of wounded, as well as some of the dead that were coming into the hospital. So there's also been an escalation on the southern Lebanese front with northern Israel. Overnight, there were more than 50 Israeli attacks on southern Lebanese villages. And as you mentioned in your report, more than 100 Hezbollah rockets have been fired across the border today.
Can you talk about what Nasrallah said yesterday?
Well, it was a very wide-ranging speech. Part of it was he looked at these attacks and he said, let's consider what Israel's aims were in this attack. And he pointed out three things. He said the first was to try and separate the Lebanese front from Gaza. And he said that won't happen until the war in Gaza ends. The second was to splinter and to pressure Hezbollah's support base to say enough. We have had enough of this. that aim also has failed. On the contrary, we have seen people who are wounded in hospitals saying that this is a sacrifice that they are prepared to make. The third thing was to disrupt Hezbollah's communications infrastructure, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that that didn't happen. He also turned to these growing Israeli calls for a ground invasion of Lebanon or to widen the war in Lebanon away from the southern Lebanese border region, but to engulf the whole country. And he said at one point that Hezbollah welcomes a ground invasion. It prefers to target Israeli soldiers on its home turf rather than in northern Israel. And he said that if Israeli soldiers cross that border, they will find themselves in hell. And he also said at one point they will also face, quote, hundreds of those who were wounded in Tuesday and Wednesday's attacks.
So what about the response to the reports from Reuters and the New York Times and other places that it was Israeli agents who were reportedly responsible? It wouldn't quite say accurate to say rigging the devices, manufacturing these devices. Not clear debate over where exactly they were manufactured, but possibly a Budapest, Hungary based company was involved. Your response to this and the UN Secretary General Guterres saying that decrying the use of everyday electronics as a weapon of war?
Well, there's speculation is rife about exactly how these devices exploded and at what point were explosives placed in them? Were they remotely hacked? Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah yesterday in a speech said that Hezbollah has set up a number of committees to investigate this and that it would, soon release the results. As for the use, turning everyday objects into IEDs, basically, there was a press release recently, moments ago before we went on air, where UN experts said that it was a terrifying violation of international law, that you can't booby trap devices that civilians might use or that may be in the vicinity of civilians. So it is to use Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's word again, unprecedented tactic, and one that is very grave, because it attacked so many different people. It wasn't a mass attack on people in the same location, but it was in at least three places across Lebanon, in South Lebanon, in the Bekaa Valley, and in Beirut.
As Guterres decries the weaponization of civilian objects, can you talk about, on the ground, in the hospitals, the kind of injuries that these hospitals that are overwhelmed are dealing with? Word is that somewhere over 3,500 people were injured.
Yes, and we have seen on Lebanese TV, we have seen trauma surgeons break down and cry as they describe some of the cases that they are dealing with. Injuries are predominantly to the eyes, to the face, to the torso, and to the hands. We have heard surgeons say that in the same operation, there are sometimes three or four specialists who are trying to save some of these wounded people. Each one is focused on a particular body part, so they are really quite devastating injuries. Some of them, there was a trauma surgeon this morning who was talking about how some of these wounded people might need multiple surgeries over a very extended period of time.
I wanted to turn to Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh speaking Thursday.
Yesterday, Secretary Austin spoke by phone with his Israeli counterpart, Minister of Defense Galant, to review regional security developments and reiterate unwavering U.S. support for Israel in the face of threats from Iran, Lebanese Hezbollah, and Iran's other regional partners. The secretary emphasized the U.S. commitment to deterring regional adversaries, de-escalating tensions across the region, and reaffirmed the priority of reaching a ceasefire deal that will bring home hostages held by Hamas, and an enduring diplomatic resolution to the conflict on the Israel-Lebanon border that will allow civilians on both sides to return home.
Can you talk about the U.S. response so far to these explosions in Lebanon? Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, was in Paris. He cautioned against any further escalations that would make a Gaza ceasefire deal even more challenging, though it looks like that has fallen apart, Rania.
Well, I can't speak to what the U.S. is to the U.S.'s point of view, but I can certainly tell you that over here, people very intimately link this Israeli offensive with the U.S. People point out the double standards in terms of international law. They also point out how, you know, Blinken and other U.S. officials talk about de-escalating the conflict while continuing to arm Israel, not only in Gaza, but also, of course, in with regard to its offensive here in Lebanon. So it's, you know, the mask has fallen on the doublespeak that is coming out of Washington.
Can you talk about the formation of Hezbollah, what its political aspirations are, and its relationship to the Lebanese government?
Well, it is part of the Lebanese government. Hezbollah has more than a dozen parliamentarians. It also has cabinet ministers, and it has had people in government for many, many years. It has a political wing, it has a military wing, and it also runs a lot of charities and schools and hospitals. It formed in 1982 as a resistance group in response to Israel's occupation, invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon. And it maintains its arms because part of Lebanon remains Israeli occupied and has been for decades.
And what you see happening now with the Israeli government, the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, saying the war is widening, the reports of troops being used, Israeli troops being moved to the north from Gaza?
Well, that's the big question. That's the question that is on the minds of many Lebanese. What happens next? Will there be a ground invasion? Will there be airstrikes? We heard the Israeli official point out targets. He mentioned the airport. He mentioned the port, Beirut's port. These are all civilian infrastructure. And let's not forget that in 2006 war with Israel, the airport was hit on day one. Beirut airport was hit on day one, rendering it unusable. So the idea that Israel would broaden its war, not just to target Hezbollah, but to target Lebanese civilian infrastructure is a grave concern over here.
I wanted to turn to your New Yorker piece. You said earlier this summer, I met with a Hezbollah military strategist in a small village in southern Lebanon, a few kilometers from the Israeli border. At one point during our off-the-record conversation, his pager beeped. He decrypted the message using a neatly folded piece of laminated paper. I hadn't seen a sheet like that since the 2006 war with Israel, when another Hezbollah militant in another southern Lebanese village pulled out one out of his pocket to relay a coded message over a walkie-talkie. The group has long used various low-tech methods, including pagers, as part of its strategy to avoid Israeli tracking and surveillance of cell phones. It also has its own landline network. Take it from there, Rania.
Well, I mean, this—I'll just go back to the 2006 incident. Not only did I saw two fighters in a southern Lebanese village, and they were using the walkie-talkies and this laminated piece of paper, but they told me about how they use coded messages. One man said, "If I tell my friend to meet me under the tree where he met his fiance." I understand it. He understands it. But even if a message like that is intercepted by the Israelis, they will not understand it. This is the advantage that Hezbollah has on its home turf. These are local men fighting in their villages. They are fighting in their towns. They are fighting in territory that they are very intimately familiar with. And they're very disciplined, very highly trained, very motivated fighting force.
And can you talk about the sonic booms that you're hearing and how that affects the Lebanese population?
Well, they're terrifying, first of all. You don't know if it's a sonic boom, and you wait to hear if there's an explosion that follows the noise. Now, this is also, you know, let's not forget that Beirut has long been terrorized by Israeli overflights, by, you know, Israeli warplanes. All of these things, incidentally, are violations of sovereignty and acts of war. Every year, the United Nations tallies up these violations and presents a report about them. They're usually in the hundreds, sometimes in the thousands, these cross-border violations. So they're not a new development per se, but given the heightened tensions, they are certainly a terrifying sound to hear in the middle of the day, because you just don't know if this is the opening salvo of an expanded war, or if it is just the boom itself and not followed by an explosion.
Are people afraid to use pagers, walkie-talkies, even their cell phones?
Beyond that, people are wondering if perhaps, you know, there were reports that people were disconnecting the lithium batteries in their homes from the solar panels to provide electricity. People were wondering what other devices might explode, what electronics in their home might explode. Some people were telling each other not to use cell phones, but to go back to landlines to communicate. So they're really, you know, this is psychologically... It's broken something, because this is a new sort of development when an everyday object can be weaponized, and it can be weaponized en masse.
Rania Abu Zeid, we thank you for being with us, Lebanese-Australian journalist and author based in Beirut. We will link to your article in the New Yorker magazine, Explosions Across Lebanon. Next up, weeks out from the U.S. election, the Uncommitted National Movement has announced it's not going to endorse Kamala Harris, even as they say they oppose President Trump and that voting for third party is a mistake. We'll speak with the co-founder of the movement. Stay with us. مسرب الوعر وآلاف الأكف السمري ترتاح على مقبض باب المواعيد أنا زغرودة والدمع على تطريز منديل I, the conscious speaker by the Lebanese jazz and folk rock musician Assam Hejali. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're just 45 days away from the U.S. election. As the Biden administration continues to supply billions of dollars in military aid to Israel, demands for a U.S. arms embargo to Israel remain a key issue among anti-war voters who say they feel ignored by the both major political parties. Now the Uncommitted National Movement, which pressured by the Democratic Party, pressured the Democratic Party to shift its policy towards Israel and to end the war in Gaza, has announced it will not endorse Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris, saying her campaign failed to accept the movement's demands, which also include meeting with Palestinian American families who've had many of their relatives killed in Israeli attacks on Gaza. With less than 2 months to go until the election, Harris has repeatedly defended the Biden administration's support of Israel amidst its relentless war on Gaza. During an interview with on Tuesday with the National Association of Black Journalists in Philadelphia, Vice President Harris was questioned on the issues by reporter Tanya Mosley of WHYY Radio.
You've called for a ceasefire hostage deal and a two-state solution as an end to the war for many months now. And while you've expressed support for Israel to defend itself, a two-state solution and a ceasefire are at odds with what Benjamin Netanyahu has said is their right to defense. If it matters, as you say, how Israel defends itself, where do you see the line between aggression and defense? And our power as Israel's ally to do something.
Okay, a lot to unpack in what you just said. So let's start with this. I absolutely believe that this war has to end, and it has to end as soon as possible. And the way that will be achieved is by getting a hostage deal and a ceasefire deal done. And we are working around the clock to achieve that end. Stepping back, October 7, 1,200 Israelis were slaughtered, and actually and some Americans, by the way, in that number, slaughtered. Young people who were attending a concert, women were horribly raped. And yes, so I have said, Israel has a right to defend itself. We would. And
but Madam Vice President, but let me finish. My ask is the difference between aggression and defense.
No, but it's important to put it in context, which is what I'm doing, and I'll get to that. And so how it does so matters. And far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. Women and children. We have seen with horror the images coming out of Gaza. And we have to take that seriously.
That was Vice President Kamala Harris being questioned Tuesday by reporter Tanya Mosley as part of a panel of journalists at the National Association of Black Journalists event in Philadelphia. Meanwhile, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump said Thursday Jewish voters will be to blame if he loses November's election. Trump stood in front of an Israeli flag as he spoke at the Israel-American Council National Summit. He also used the term Palestinian as a pejorative to describe Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and New York Democrat, and claimed if Kamala Harris wins in November, Israel would cease to exist.
The Jewish people would have a lot to do with a loss. If I'm at 40%, think of it, that means 60% of voting for Kamala, who in particular is a bad Democrat. The Democrats are bad to Israel, very bad. I mean, Chuck Schumer is a Palestinian. But if we don't win this election, Israel, in my opinion, within a period of 2 to 3 years, will cease to exist. It's going to be wiped out. That's what's going to happen.
Trump previously referred to President Biden as a, quote, very bad Palestinian, unquote, in their only presidential debate in June. This all comes as the Teamsters Union said it's not endorsing a presidential candidate for the first time since 1996. The union, which endorsed Biden in 2020, says neither candidate had enough support from their 1.3 million strong membership. For more on the election and the uncommitted movement's announcement, it will not endorse Kamala Harris. We go to Detroit. We go to Michigan, where we're joined by Lexis Edan, co-founder and co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain the statement that you put out yesterday, Lexis?
Yeah. Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me on the show. As many know, Uncommitted put out a statement yesterday where we announced we will not be endorsing a Democratic presidential candidate, Kamala Harris. And in that same statement, we had announced that we are vehemently opposing Donald Trump and that we do not recommend a third party vote. And to put it into a little bit of context, we have been working for months where we, you know, started in Michigan, 1.5 million voter contacts, mobilized over 101,000 people to go to the polls and vote uncommitted as a protest vote against Biden and the administration and their ongoing support for Israel as it relates to the occupation and killing of Palestinians. And what we offered to VP Harris is that if Vice President Kamala Harris is able to do two things, either change policy as it relates to current U.S. policy that backs bombs, or simply does the thing of ensuring and upholding current international and human rights laws as it relates to the way that Israel is violating war crimes, that we would do repeat what we did in Michigan to mobilize our base to go to the polls and vote for her come November. It was an offer we put on the table that was declined by Vice President Kamala Harris and her campaign team. And so because we were not met in good faith, we had to make the decision to not be able to endorse her. And to be clear, an endorsement is an opportunity for us to do the same thing that we did in Michigan, to mobilize our voters. An endorsement means that we are offering something and doing something. And because we were not met in good faith with our policy demands, it is something that we cannot do.
So explain each position, not endorsing Kamala Harris, telling people not to support President Trump or a third-party candidate.
Yeah, great question. I think I'll lead with, we have to be very clear, is that there's two options come November at the top of the ticket. It's going to be Vice President Kamala Harris or former President Donald Trump. So keeping that context in mind, we had to make a decision of what that means to grow the power that we've already built within our anti-war organizing movement. And so for us, like I said, an endorsement is meaning that we will mobilize voters to go to the polls and vote for VP Harris. That has to come with policy change. And no policy change came, so it's a decision we had to make to not endorse her. Donald Trump, we have to be very clear, is a direct threat to our society, our civil liberties here and Palestinians back home. As he has mentioned that he plans to annex the West Bank, as he has mentioned that he plans to criminalize organizations here in our own country who are fighting for Palestinian human rights. And then to the third point of not recommending a third party vote, we know that unfortunately a third party vote is not viable in this broken electoral system. And so inadvertently a third party vote would support a Donald Trump victory. And so knowing all this context, we believe that our power lies within our movement, that our power lies within our people, that our power lies in continuing to grow the anti-war organizing movement that we have to truly pressure the Democratic coalition or the Democratic administration to change policy as it relates to its current U.S. policy of backing bombs.
Speaking of third parties, this month, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE, published a follow-up poll that shows Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein ahead of Kamala Harris among Muslim voters in the key swing states of Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin. So can you talk about the significance of what this means of not endorsing Kamala Harris?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to recognize that a lot of people, especially people within the Arab and Muslim community, you know, as VP Harris put it in her speech, we got to put things into context. And the context here is that these communities are communities that are suffering. They are communities that are grieving. And the idea of people going and asking them who you are voting for come November, we've said this repeatedly, is like asking them that question at a funeral. And so we have to keep in context how people are grieving, feeling emotionally. The very same people who came out in 2020 and mobilized very well for Biden, who feels very betrayed by this administration. And so we believe as a movement that it's our responsibility to do three things right in this very moment is one, educate voters across the country, including Arab and Muslim voters, provide them with voter education on the dangers of Donald Trump. Two, recognize that the genocide is still happening, that we cannot wait till January to shift policy, and that we have to continue to pressure the Biden-Harris administration to change policy immediately to save as many Palestinian lives as possible. And the third thing is to continue to grow our anti-war organizing power with Democratic coalitions across the country. We have to recognize that our power has impacted elected officials speaking up for Palestine as well, from school board members all the way up to congressional leaders that are talking openly about why we need to change our U.S. foreign policy as it relates to backing bombs. And so these people that are talking about voting Jill Stein in third party are people who are suffering. And we believe it is our job to continue to do the organizing work that we have to do ahead of November to educate our voters about what's at stake come November and how we have to grow our organizing power to see long-term policy change to lead to a liberated and a free Palestine.
Finally, your response to Senator Bernie Sanders preparing a joint resolution of disapproval against the planned $20 billion in U.S. arms sales to Israel, he spoke from the Senate floor Wednesday.
Netanyahu's policies have trampled on international law, made life unlivable in Gaza, and created one of the worst humanitarian disasters in modern history. The simple fact is that we must end our complicity in Israel's illegal and indiscriminate military campaign, which has caused mass civilian death and suffering.
We have 30 seconds, Lexis. Your response?
Yeah, I mean, he highlighted it perfectly, is that we are aiding and abetting in indiscriminately killing civilians. And it goes to the point of what we've been explaining in this movement and what we've been trying to get VP Harris and the administration to move on, a sentiment that actually resonates with the majority of Democrats, 77% of Democrats, 61% of Americans, that oppose weapons aids to Israel. When we look at our international law and our U.S. law as it relates to violation of war crimes, this is something we should not be funding. So what we're asking is not outrageous. We're making a very simple request to follow international law and do what's right and create an opportunity to de-escalate what's happening in the region and to really make sure that we're valuing Palestinian lives as much as any other lives.
Lexis Zaidan, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, speaking to us from Detroit, Michigan. Next up is Donald Trump continues to refuse to admit he lost the 2020 election. We'll speak with filmmaker Michael Primo, who embedded with three Trump supporters around the 2020 election, one of them an insurrectionist who has been sentenced to one of the longest prison terms for participating in January 6th. Stay with us.
Rainbows out in Gaza, from the mountains to Ramallah. My blood mixes with the dirt. I smile despite the overwhelming hurt. Lay me down and kiss my wound. Beneath the waters of the same moon. Yeah. How many angels have to die for you to cry? Under that Gazan sky, there is no hope for mercy. How many fathers cry themselves to sleep at night, closing their daughter's eyes, kissing one last goodbye? If only I could change the rules of space and time, I would bend the light of day.
Kiss My Wounds by Palestinian American singer Anis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Secret Service recently announced the next electoral count after the November election is scheduled for January 6, 2025. This time, the event will be classified under the same security level as the inauguration itself. The move follows a request by Washington, D.C.'s mayor and a recommendation by the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. This comes as former President Trump dodged a question about his January 6 actions and refused to acknowledge his 2020 loss when he was asked about it by debate moderator David Muir during last week's debate with Kamala Harris.
You were the president. You were watching it unfold on television. It's a very simple question as we move forward toward another election. Is there anything you regret about what you did on that day? Yes, sir.
I had nothing to do with that other than they asked me to make a speech. It would have never happened if Nancy Pelosi and the mayor of Washington did their jobs. I wasn't responsible for security. Nancy Pelosi was responsible. She didn't do her job.
The question was about you as president, not about former Speaker Pelosi.
This comes as a new documentary offers a close-up look at Trump supporters in the run-up to the 2020 election, including members of the far-right group, the Proud Boys. Homegrown follows three right-wing Trump supporters before and after the 2020 election, when they become convinced it was stolen and take to the streets. The film just had its world premiere at the Venice Film Festival. In a minute, we'll speak with the director who embedded with them, including on January 6. But first, this clip from Homegrown that features Chris Gueglin, a New Jersey electrician who's one of the three people the film follows. It follows him as he divides his time between preparing to become a parent and stocking up to prepare for war. This clip is from January 5th, 2021, as he arrives at his hotel room in Washington, D.C. before the insurrection.
Dude, I got so many filters. This is what all this was. I literally have two pair of pants, three shirts, and gas masks and body armor. And I had eight bags.
And I this gas mask if necessary. Holy
and a taser. I think it might be legal. It's floatable. All this is my survival. This is all medical. Trauma, bullet wounds, tampons, because they're great for knife wounds. people are like, oh, we're going to have a civil war. And I'm like, oh, I've been planning for this for 10 years. Are you kidding me? You're These right. things are bad, dude. And you're not breaking through them. I don't care if they're from China or not. My wife's from China. She's the best lady I ever met. So I don't care if they're from China or not. You're not breaking through those. And if I would love to see some Antifa, like, just hogtied.
Chris Quaglin has since been sentenced to one of the longest prison terms for participating in the insurrection. For more, we're joined by Michael Primo, director of Homegrown, executive producer of Storyline. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This is a powerful, rare, behind-the-scenes account of what happened. Talk more about Chris, this guy who ends up, what, being sentenced to 11, 12 years for assaulting a police officer, among other things?
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So Chris, one of the three protagonists in the film, is an electrician from Jersey who, before 2016, never considered himself political. He said before Donald Trump ran for president, he never paid attention to even local or national elections. But he was so inspired by what he heard coming from Trump that he felt sort of compelled and called to become an activist.
Let's go back to Homegrown, to another clip of Chris Quaglin and his friends in his truck as they drive in a Trump train protest.
There is a lot more patriots in this country than what the mainstream media tells us. You look out here and you'll never see a Joe Biden rally quite like this. There are millions of patriots out there. We will stand down and stand by and wait for the president's call.
Trump 2020, baby!
We should have tied Antifa to the pole right here in the back.
Dude, you tie him like Jesus. Crucify him.
Tie him up. But tie him up, not nail him.
Yeah, just tape
so
him.
You could
duct tape,
him
bro.
Down and
duct tape.
Out when we, yeah.
Duct tape.
And with no clothes on.
100%.
No clothes.
You have to, but you leave the mask on.
Yeah, leave his mask on. You don't want him to get a flu, you know? God forbid if he gets a cold.
There's a sheriff.
You got pulled over. Not with Trump flags, but.
Not with Trump flags, we're not.
Nah.
If, as long as I wasn't.
You could shoot somebody and you won't get pulled over.
He said you could shoot someone here and you wouldn't get pulled over. That was Long Island. President Trump just spoke at the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island this week. Talk about what a Trump train is.
Yeah, Trump train was a kind of an anomaly of the pandemic era campaign, presidential campaign, where in lieu of or in addition to some of the large scale rallies that were happening, people would gather in a long line of cars and drive around a particular area. People may have remembered there was also boat trains where people would gather and do the same thing in a long line of boats and sort of parade around a lake. And it was similar. And they happened around the country.
I want to go to another clip, and this is of Proud Boy Thad Cisneros, an activist from Texas, who you show as he teams up with a Black Lives Matter activist named Jakari Kelly. This is a clip of them together as they drive in another Trump train protest.
Girl, what you doing, girl? What you doing, girl? Black Lives Matter, girl!
We are in a caravan going one direction.
There's some more.
And it's a Patriots Against Racism. That's what it is. Patriots Against Racism. So then, can I flip this around? There we go. So they organized another event, the BLM Utah, and you can see them. And they're being very stunning and brave, and they're flipping everybody off.
But that works vice versa, because when I was in a caravan, the Trump supporters were flipping us off.
No, it's very stupid.
Way more attention than there needs.
Yeah, exactly. Both Jakari and myself are of what I think is a very good opinion, that you should allow the other side to voice their opinion without any kind of reprisal. You know, this is a demonstration of what I would consider to be unity amongst people with the same opinion.
So why not just have American flags?
Well, these guys are Trump supporters. They're voicing their opinion.
But if it's anti-racism, like what's
that? Oh my gosh, Trump is not synonymous with racism. Let's not go there, Jakari.
So is this a Trump caravan or is this supposed to be like a patriot caravan?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Because right. It's just patriots against racism.
Looks like okay. It's a Trump caravan.
See, at least I'm trying to understand. But can we agree that Donald Trump is not synonymous with racism? Please.
I see you said some racist ass. I'll say that part.
We got guys in New York, one of which is married to a black woman with black children. And
that doesn't make you not racist if you have a black family.
I cannot grasp that concept.
No, you still have that little prejudice.
that is complete nonsense to me.
Oh my God.
That is complete nonsense.
That's like saying a black person can't be prejudiced against a Mexican person.
So that's Proud Boy Thad Cisneros, who now is in jail in Texas, not related to January 6th.
Yeah, he's in jail for aggravated assault under unrelated to his political activity.
Talk, I mean, you're a filmmaker of color. You embedded with these guys, most of them white, but some of them activists of color. Talk about that.
I mean, I think going into this project, I had a vision or understanding of the conservative movement as much more white than what I encountered, and why it was important to include Thad in the film, as well as a couple of the sort of minor participants that you see in the background throughout the film, is because they represent this increasing participation of black and Latino people, mostly men, who are sort of feeling inspired by the conservative movement and can increasingly see themselves as foot soldiers in this movement.
I mean, you have a scene in Portland, Oregon. This is after January 6th, where they are shooting up the area. Weapons are a big part of what they do.
Yeah, weapons are absolutely critical. And I think that's also the draw for some people, some men of color, this sort of feeling of power and feeling powerful and being near other people who are sort of reclaiming power, so to speak.
Why did they accept you?
It's a good question. I'd love to ask them that question. I think some of these people were generally interested in talking to somebody who may not necessarily agree with everything that they stand for, but was interested in talking to them. And that sort of confused and confounded people and really encouraged folks to try to talk to me in a way that I wasn't prepared for or didn't expect initially.
Have you spoken to Chris since he has been in prison?
I've talked to Chris Chris was arrested in April of 2021, and he was held without bail until his sentencing, which happened earlier this year. And I talked to him a bunch of times throughout his incarceration while he was awaiting trial.
Does he regret what he did?
No, he feels like he's being railroaded and completely sort of jammed up by the system, so to speak, and sees himself as a political prisoner.
Why'd you call it homegrown?
Because I think very often when we talk about these tensions, these divisions, people in the media often refer to other people coming into a place from somewhere else. And we really want to make clear that this is a homegrown issue, a homegrown problem that we need to address.
So you were just at the Venice Film Festival. What's next?
We have about 25 festivals coming up around the United States and Europe. And those festivals will be listed at homegrown.film as they become live.
What do you expect to happen next? January 6th.
I feel like that if the if this was a foreign country, the State Department would issue travel advisories for this fall. So I'm very concerned with the height of sort of violent rhetoric that only seems to have gotten worse since last year. I feel like perhaps on January 6th, we might not see what we did in 2021. But between the election and January 6th, I think we were prepared for an escalation of violence.
Michael Primo, director of the new documentary, Homegrown. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, namaskar, assalamu alaikum, and sat sri akal, and welcome to another edition of Surtal, right here on 92.3 FM, CFMU. I'm your host, Narinder. We have another great show for you, 1 hour of Hindi music and 1 hour of Punjabi music, right here on 93.3 FM, CFMU, and sit back, relax, and enjoy today's show. Lots of great new songs that we're going to play, but first of all, let's start off with some oldies but goldies. लीजिए शुरू करते हैं ये कार्यक्रम फ्रॉम द फिल्म कुर्बानी. दिस इज मनहर उदास. दिस इज द सॉन्ग हम तुम्हें चाहते हैं. राइट हियर ऑन सरताल रेडियो.
हम तुम्हें चाहते हैं ऐसे हम तुम्हें चाहते हैं ऐसे मरने वाला कोई मरने वाला कोई जिंदगी चाहता हो जैसे हम तुम्हें चाहते हैं.